Welcome back to another episode of Chasing the Apex. I'm your host, Sid Sudhir, and today we are sitting down with racing driver Stingray Robb. Stingray first got into go-kart at age 5, and it wasn't long before he was racing competitively, winning a national karting championship in 2015. This helped springboard him into his car racing career, starting with the Pro Mazda series before transitioning to the Indy Pro 2000 series. He spent 2 years in Indy Pro with Juncos, winning the series in 2020, which earned him a move up to the Indy Lights series. In 2022, Robb had another impressive series with Andretti in the Indy Lights series, finishing second in the standings with 2 poles and 1 race win. Welcome to the show, Stingray. It's an absolute pleasure to have you with us here today. My first question for you, I know I have to be the millionth person in your life to ask you this, but how did you end up with literally the best name I've ever heard?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty clear that it's not the most normal name in the world. And you're right. You might be the millionth person to ask me how I got the name Stingray. But the short story is that both my parents were Corvette fans. And so they decided to name me after the Stingray Corvette. The longer story, if we've got time.
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. So the long story is that my dad's heritage, his side of the family, is from Stirlingshire, Scotland. So Sting is actually short for Sterling. And then both of my grandpas had Ray in their name. And so we took all that together and combined it and got Stingray. So here I am, a race car driver with a crazy name.
So, well, I need to ask you now, do you own a Corvette?
Not yet. It's on the bucket list. My dad does, though. So I'm living vicariously through him.
So, I mean, do you have like a classic, or does your dad have a classic, you know, Corvette Stingray?
He does. Yeah. He has a 1966 Stingray Corvette, and it's not the most original thing in the world. He actually used to drag race it. So it's got around 800 horsepower and it looks unbelievable, but it's so much fun to drive just because it's all horsepower.
You know, well, no, I think that's kind of nice that you were named after a car. Your profession is now driving cars. So there's some nice symmetry there. So no, that's great. I mean, that kind of goes into my next question then. So what really started your interest in motorsport? Was it trying to live up to the name, or was it just sort of chance that you got a go-kart and then the rest was sort of history?
Yeah. So I think that it kind of started with the name. You know, my passion for racing, I think, started with my parents, and they kind of passed that along to me through my name. But even as a young kid, like, we were going to Corvette club meetings, drag races, autocross events. So I just spent time around these cool old fast cars. And when I was 4, I watched a Nitro Circus video on YouTube of Travis Pastrana jumping a go-kart into a foam pit. And it's like, oh, that's what I want to do. And so I asked for a go-kart for my 5th birthday, not telling my parents that that's what I was planning on doing by jumping a go-kart into a foam pit. But anyway, so I got one for my 5th birthday and started traveling around from there. You know, pretty soon we were going to Italy. By the time I was 9, we were going to Canada all the time, back and forth. And so it just, that hobby turned into a career pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you said, right, you competed in karting races all across the world. I think even Spain and Portugal, right? I can't think of a place more different from Idaho than Spain or Portugal, right? So what was that like for you as a kid, you know, traveling to all these different places and, you know, being of the state of mind of actually being able to compete, right? Because when I go to a new country, it's already, you know, interesting enough. There's all these different things. But on top of that, as a young kid, having to go with that mindset and focus of being ready to compete, what was that like?
Man, it was crazy. It's kind of funny. Like, I always say that you only know what you know. And so, like, for me as a kid, like, I was homeschooled for a good part of my schooling career. And so I didn't have other kids saying, like, dude, you're crazy. Like, why are you going to Spain? Why are you going to Portugal? So, until later on. So, like, once I got into high school, I realized, like, okay, what I'm doing is actually pretty significant and special. But, like, I really enjoyed going to Europe. I thought it was super cool to see the sights and everything. But most of the time, we were just at the racetrack. And so I was very engaged and locked in on what my job was as a driver. And like maybe in the afternoons or something after the races were done, we'd go see, you know, like a cool historic landmark or something like that. But for the most part, like, I don't think I was able to appreciate where I was and what I was doing in the sense that I didn't have a reference of like how unique and special that was at that time. So looking back, I'd probably like to go back and see those things again, being a little bit older and seeing, okay, like, this is pretty cool. This is pretty unique.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and looking back on it, do you feel obviously very different from a lot of the kids that, you know, at your age when you were growing up, but do you feel that you were able to have a quote unquote regular childhood? Do you feel like you were able to experience some of those things, or is that something that you feel
sure
you had to, okay. So you didn't feel like you had to sacrifice something in order to be a racer?
I probably did sacrifice a bit. I mean, during my karting years, there was a couple years there. I was gone out of town 42 weekends a year. And so that was a significant amount of time to be on the road traveling from race to race to race. And usually it was me and my dad hopping in the truck and driving across the country, or my grandparents toting the cart trailer across the country to Florida or something. And then we would fly in after, you know, I had a test or something for, you know, school. Mm-hmm. But I still played sports all the way through high school. I still got to spend my time as being a kid. But definitely seeing the world in a different view, I think, than a lot of other people my age, just because, I mean, I was traveling the world. I was, you know, pursuing a career at a very young age. And so I think it's probably similar to what Olympic athletes might go through. Maybe not as rigorous in the sense of training and whatnot, but like, I really enjoyed what I did, but I also got to be a child. I got to, you know, go camping in the summer. I got to go to school. I got to have that best friend in high school or whatever, and goof off and do all those things. So yeah, I mean, like I said, I played sports. I played basketball, baseball. I played tennis a little bit. I golfed, snow skied, hunted, fished, hiked. I mean, I did all the things. So I didn't feel like I got to miss out on a whole lot. I may not have spent as much time doing those things as other kids were, but I still got to check those things off the list.
Yeah. I mean, 42 weekends of the year, you're doing something equally, if not more interesting, right? So, yeah. I mean, so looking back on it, right, you spent a lot of time in Europe. And so, you know, as a young Carter, why were you going over to Europe? Did you have the ambition of first of going into Formula One, and that's why you were spending time outside the United States?
Yeah. I mean, initially, when I first got into go-karting, that was the dream, right? We all see the big story of being an F1 driver. And I think about the time I was 9, maybe, the Ayrton Senna documentary came out. And we went and watched that in the theater. And I was like, oh my gosh, this guy is unbelievable. I want to be just like him. And so like, that was a dream. F1 was like the goal. And so when we started traveling over to Europe, I think it was initially because that's just where the competition was. So I raced in the Rotax category, which their grand finals were always over at the end of the season in Europe. And so that's why I got to go to Spain and Portugal. But I did also other events, like I went to Belgium in 2016. I drove for the CRG factory team in the KC2 category. And so we got to go to Italy several times, went to France and did the KZ over there. So I think that for the most part, yeah, yeah.
I mean, so what was it like competing in those sort of series? Because I've had a few drivers kind of joke with me that, like, in some ways, going to those, you know, big like categories like Rotax or driving for a factory karting team, in some ways, is actually more competitive than maybe going to like Spanish F4 or something like that, right? So
I think it is. I really do.
You feel like there was like an immense learning curve there, that you really learned a lot even before you got into like an actual car?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think the deal is that we always say that there is no true ladder system in open wheel racing. The closest thing that you do have to one is the road to Indy. And so that's why I chose that ladder. But for the most part, it's shattered glass. I mean, there's so many different directions you can go, and you see drivers take different routes to get to different places in their career. And so like for karting, like that's kind of the pinnacle of the sport, right? Like when you get to Europe and you're racing for a factory team, you know that, I mean, there's guys that are 25, 30 years old that I was racing when I was, it was 2016. So I was 14 years old at that time, competing against these guys that are paid professionals over there. And so it's just a different culture and a different kind of a sport than it is here in the US, where, you know, over here it's a bit more of a hobby, but you can make a living over there in Europe. And it's super competitive. I mean, because the culture just speaks into motorsports, it allows the pool of drivers to be so much bigger. So the high level competition might be equal, but the field is just a lot deeper on the other side. So I think for the most part, you'll see drivers that are young graduate through the junior karting ranks and then go into something like the Spanish F4 or something. But there's so many different categories when you enter into the junior formulas. And so you don't see that competition stack up as much as like you do in that top level of karting. You know, it's similar to like IndyCar, right? Like you'll see drivers in the road to Indy move their way up, and then they get an IndyCar and they do really well. But the depth of talent is much higher in IndyCar because you have build up year over year over year over year. I mean, you look at guys like Will Power, Simon Pagenaud, Helio Castroneves, like those guys have been around for a long time, and they're still very competitive. And mm-hmm. it's every year you're getting a driver, maybe two, that are at that caliber to compete. And so I think the same thing happens in karting, where it just stacks up year after year after year as new drivers come into the series.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like you said, when you were age nine, went and watched the Ayrton Senna documentary, really loved F1. So, you know, what was that turning point for you then when you decided, like, hey, IndyCar is the route for me, not necessarily F1? And mentally, what was that like? Did that feel like a little sad that maybe you know, quote unquote, giving up on F1? Or did you feel like really comfortable with your decision to chase IndyCar?
You know, I think at the time when I watched that Ayrton Senna documentary, I didn't even really know what IndyCar was. and so I didn't have a concept of open wheel racing in America. I just saw F1 and I'm like, that's the pinnacle. That's where I want to be. Mm-hmm. And I think I still hold that value. I think that F1 is the top tier for engineering and just vehicle dynamics. Mm-hmm. And also the drivers are really high level there. But I think for level of competition, IndyCar is probably the most exciting to watch, just because you don't have only two or three teams that are able to win. I mean, there's mm-hmm. four, five, six teams that are competitive depending on the weekend. And so I think that as I got older, I started to realize that where I wanted to be was somewhere where I could be competitive, in the sense that I wanted to have an opportunity. And there's something to be said for being home. You know, being in Europe, I learned, like, this is a completely different culture. It's not necessarily where my family's at, it's not where my friends are. It doesn't feel like home as much as it did in America. And so I think there's probably a turning point in 2016 when I was driving for the CRG factory team. I wanted to try everything. So I did dirt cars, I did NASCAR, I did go-karts, I did open wheel. And I wanted to just figure out what I wanted to do for a career. And we were racing over in Italy, and I had a bad race or something. And I finally was like, all right, Dad, it was just me and my dad over there. I was like, Dad, I want to go home. Like, I just want to go race at home. And so we came back to the US, did one race here. And I'm like, okay, yeah, this is where I want to be. Let's go to cars. And so I think that was kind of like the turning point. And it was never a disappointed, sad, I wish that I could have stuck to the path to go to F1. I think it was like truly out of desire to stay in the US in a very competitive open wheel category and work my way up to the ranks here. Because I think, to be honest, if you take the top five drivers in IndyCar and place them against the top five in F1, I would be interested to see how competitive those drivers would be against each other, just because I think IndyCar is a little underrated in that sense, because the cars are not that high of level of engineering, and they're a stock series, but that's what makes the racing so much more enjoyable to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think people get like a bad, IndyCar gets a bad rep, right? Because people, I think, see stock series, immediately think that the cars are not as highly engineered as F1 cars, which maybe in some ways, yes and no, right? Mm-hmm. But no, I have to agree with you that I very much in my own path, right? I kind of started down the Formula One path as well. And after spending this past summer with IndyCar, really my eyes opened to that as well. And I think a lot of problems that people talk about with F1 is a sport, and a lot, you know, like, I think there's journalists who make an entire career out of talking about how Formula One could be better, right? And then, absolutely. And you can kind of come over to IndyCar and then and see the way that things are run, and a lot of those things just aren't even a discussion in IndyCar, because it's just most races on average are probably, I would say, at least for me, are more interesting to watch in terms of pure on-track action compared to Formula One, right? So I think there is some merit that, you know, the fact that there are so many teams that can be competitive. And I agree with you. I do think that IndyCar is very underrated, in the sense that there's a high, high level of talent on the grid. And I think one thing that really excites me is that, in addition to guys like you who are trying to get into the series, we do have a lot of talent from Europe who's coming over. You know, Callum Ilott, now we have Marcus Armstrong coming, you know, as well. Christian Lundgaard is another great example, right? A lot of people who are coming from that, you know, quote unquote ladder into Formula One and coming into IndyCar and doing really well too. So I think that's just made it a very competitive series overall.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's something to be said for the American dream, right? Like those drivers that are coming from Europe over to here are because they kind of hit a dead end in the road. And it wasn't because of their lack of talent or anything. It was just, there's no openings in F1. And so to come to IndyCar, you're seeing a lot higher of a car count, a very competitive field. So it's not like F1 where they have to take a risk on a team and maybe do okay, and then a bigger team picks them up 5 years down the road. And so IndyCar, you can step into a seat. Like, look at Christian Lundgaard, Ray Hall Letterman. They're a very competitive team, but they're maybe not a Ganassi or Penske or Andretti or McLaren. They're a lower level team in that sense, but he's still very competitive, rookie of the year, and like in contention for race wins. And that's his first season in IndyCar. And yeah. So I think that for a lot of drivers, there's an appeal there to come and be a racer. You know, you don't have to go through the politics and the drama and like the hopefulness of like, maybe someone drops out, maybe someone does this, that, or another thing. Like, you can kind of earn your way into a seat.
Yeah. I mean, it's really funny you mentioned that, because I have probably, what was it, a year or 2 years ago, I think I knew about 2-3 European drivers who all at the same time were, whether it was IndyCar or IndyPro, Indy Lights, they were all coming over here to the States at the same time. And that was, you know, I remember kind of joking with them. I was like, you guys are from like cool cities. You're like from London and here and there. Like, why do you want to come in, you know, boring Midwest Indianapolis? Why do you want to be here? Right. And, you know, that's exactly what their mindset was like, you know, America is like the land of opportunity, right, for them in that sense. And that is kind of like one refreshing thing that there isn't, you know, there's some politics, there is that, you know, that's there.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, IndyCar is very much about just racing and not so much about like the thrills and frills, right? So there is something to be said about that, I think, as well, and something that's attractive, like, about that to a lot of drivers.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to quote Ayrton Senna from his documentary, but he always said that karting was the purest form of motorsports. And I think that's very true. And I think that IndyCar is the purest form of motorsports in open wheel racing. I don't think that there's too many other places that you can look and say, yeah, like that is real racing.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, like being a go-karter in my history of, you know, of what I've done, I think that this is where I wanted to be, because I had been doing it. It's something that I'd enjoyed very much so, and wanted to continue on in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, let's get back onto like the trajectory of your career, right? Karts. And then you came back to the States, moved to cars, right? So mm-hmm. One thing for any young driver, right, is they have to very quickly learn the skill of raising money, right? Learning how to market themselves. And,
yeah.
You know, there's people that go and they get a 4-year degree in this and then they know how to do it, right? For like a 12, 13-year-old to learn how to do that, it's something, right? And I've met drivers who, you know, very talented people behind the wheel, right? But then one thing where they lack is knowing how to market themselves, knowing how to start those conversations. And in some ways that can hold them back, right? So
for sure.
at that young age, like, how was that a skill that you learned to execute and be good at?
Yeah, no, I think it's just like anything else. You got to have a good team around you. You know, in racing, you'll see one guy in the driver's seat crossing the start and finish line, but there's a lot of people behind the scenes that you don't realize that are making a difference in their career. And so that goes for the on-track performance and the off-track performance of what you're talking about, raising the dollars, marketing, et cetera. So at an early spot in my car career, I was actually picked up by Peter Rossi as my manager. And that's Alexander Rossi's father. And so we used a similar program to what they got for Alexander to get him into IndyCar, or actually F1 at that time, and then transition to IndyCar. So essentially it was an investment program that allowed people to invest in my career. And then that allowed me to use that as a tool to market to different people. And so without that, it's kind of hard to utilize anything, because junior level formula is not a big marketing giant, right? Like, it's not a marketing machine. There's not a big television corporate deal that you can sell. There's not a big you know, brand that wants to jump on, because it's like there's so many eyes on it. Like, you're kind of performing under the radar at that point. It's kind of like being in high school or something, right? Like, you work your way through high school and sports, and then you get a scholarship to go to college, and then college is like your education, and then finally you get to the NBA or MLB or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so like junior formulas are kind of that same way, where you're kind of like earning your stripes, preparing yourself for that next step. And then once you get to the big time, then you can sign the big label deal. And so during my junior formula career, like, I had Peter around me. I had my mom, which we called my momager, which is my mom and my manager. And so between those two, we were able to kind of build this other group of people that kind of supported me all the way through.
I mean, so when you say invest in, like, what exactly is that? So it's like, are your investors going to cash in when and if you make it to IndyCar, or like, yep, what exactly are they doing?
No, that's exactly it. So it's they've used similar programs for racehorses. Golfers have used it. I think Taylor Swift actually used a similar program to get her first label deal. And so it's just a way that you break that, you take a loan out, right? You take that loan out and then you invest that money to go on and do something else with it.
So, I mean, is that then you're just, when you get like a paid contract as a driver, then you're just paying people back in that sense, or?
Yep. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, because, okay, I have heard this before. I think I know another driver who is also like part of the Rossi management tree. So he's mentioned something like this, and I never really fully understood it. But, you know, you're right in the sense that a lot of times it is very difficult to just, you know, purely on name value. Like maybe in Europe, in some places, you can make the argument a little bit better than, you know, Indy Lights, Indy Pro. But yeah, it's like probably at most, right? A sponsor realistically, you're going to get a nice Instagram photo that might get a few likes or something like that. But beyond that, unless you're in IndyCar, Formula One, it's kind of hard to get a lot of marketing value out of racing, right?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm sure there's other ways to do it. There's other ways around the tricks of the trade, you know? And so I think that there's other drivers that have made it without a program like what I have. And I mean, for sure there have been. There's drivers that have been just purely talented and worked their way up through and had people to believe in them all along the way. And then they step up in, but sometimes it's not that easy. You know, things don't always go your way. So you have to be prepared for something to go wrong, you know, cover your assets a little bit and make sure that you're good to go.
So you spent some time in Pro Mazda and even competed in a NASCAR race, but then moved to Indy Pro in Indy Pro 2000, where you really showed your quality. So what allowed you to be successful in that series, in your opinion?
You know, I think stepping up through the ranks before that, I was a bit out of my league, you know, jumping from karts straight into that. I was pretty young, didn't have a lot of seat time. And then when I finally got into Indy Pro 2000, again, I'm going to mention the people that were around me. You know, I joined on with Juncos Racing in 2019, and that was my second year in Indy Pro 2000 with a new car there. And they kind of just helped develop me as a driver. I mean, learning the basics all over again. You know, when you step from karts into cars, it's different mechanics. You have to drive the car differently, but, you know, kind of the same principles apply. You have to be adventurous in the car. You have to be curious of like, okay, where can I brake? How deep can I go? Is this the right technique? Can I, you know, you're doing a lot of self-learning in the car while on the track. And so being with Juncos, they kind of allowed me to do that. And they had a good enough program around them that, you know, I didn't have to worry about completely developing a car around my driving style. It was kind of like, okay, I can change myself and adapt myself. And so when I came back in 2020, I had a different level of driving ability and different level of confidence because I knew what the variables were. I didn't have to start all over. And so I ended up winning the championship in 2020. And I think that was just because like the group around me was believing in who I was and what I was doing. And they developed the toolbox that I needed to be successful.
And what do you think makes Juncos such a, I mean, because, okay, people know Juncos now having, or I guess Juncos Hollinger now, right? They competed their first year in IndyCar with Cal Mayelot, right? So people might know that name through IndyCar, but I think a lot of people before that knew them as being a top name in the feeder series, right? In Indy Lights, in Road to Indy Pro, they're always very good. And, you know, like a lot of drivers always be hoping they could get a program with Juncos. So what do you think made them such a nice environment to be in, such a helpful environment in which a driver could really grow?
Yeah. I mean, that's a tough question because there's a lot of keys to success in motorsports. And one thing that I learned pretty early on is there are no absolutes, in racing. There's not always a perfect answer. So, one thing that I will say about Juncos is that they started from nothing and they worked their tail ends off to get to where they are. And so I think that a lot of their success comes from their dedication and hard work. Ricardo's a great example of that because he's so involved in the team. I think that, you know, having his brother be a mechanic, he gets hands-on. And during that 2020 season, I had my engineer from the season before, but Ricardo was also very helpful in developing a car that was what I needed, you know, based off the previous season's experience. So, I mean, he's sitting in the engineering room with us, listening to what I'm saying, listening to what the engineer is saying and making decisions. And I think that his experience level in the feeder series, along with the people that he's put through his program, it just allows him to pull from that bank of knowledge that he's got. But I think that it's also being selective of who you bring on to your team. You know, at that point, Victor Franzoni was my driver coach. And that was someone that had previously been successful in junior formulas and understood the techniques behind being successful in a Dreamer Formula car. And then also my engineer, like he was someone that was an up and coming talent. And Ricardo, I think, just worked hand in hand with him to develop a car that was what we needed.
Mm-hmm. And so now Kunkos Hollinger has stated that they do want to have a second seat, you know, coming in this upcoming season. So you race for Kunkos in Indy Pro and Indy Lights. So do you still have, you know, good relationship with them, good contact with them?
I have to be careful what I say here. We are working on an IndyCar deal for next season, and there's obviously not very many seats available. Mm-hmm. So Kunkos is one of the two teams that we have been in conversations with this offseason.
Nice. Yeah, well, that's very exciting. And I think, you know, they've done a very good job, you know, for being like a new team. I know, I guess that last year was the first full year that they competed, right? The year before that they did the last, mm-hmm. I think, last three races of the season. But I think they've done a very good job, very impressive. And, you know, their reputation sort of precedes themselves in the other series that they've competed in. So that would certainly be a good place to end up.
For sure. Yeah. And they're very impressive for only having one car. You know, it's not too often that you see teams with one car be that competitive, just because when you have two or more cars, you see their game elevate each other a little bit. They can test over here. They can go this direction over here. And then they are able to do more research in that time. So the fact that Callum was able to qualify on the front row at Laguna Seca this year was pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, that was certainly a big moment. I mean, just to pivot a little bit, right? I'm just talking maybe about some of the fitness and training required to be a driver. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you said that you play a lot of different sports growing up, in particular had an affection for CrossFit and running. So did this sort of cardio-centric regimen put you in a good spot when it came time to compete in Indy Pro and time to compete in cars?
Yeah, I think it did. The thing with racing is that the only way to train for racing is to race. I mean, optimally, the best thing that you can do to train is to be in the car. And so I started doing training with PitFit, and I've been doing it for the last 2 years with them. As last season, I didn't start till about halfway through with them. But during the 2020 season, I saw a big gain in my performance just because there's little tricks of the trade here where you're working on reaction, eyesight, muscle endurance, muscle strength. And, you know, racing is a very specific sport because the muscles that we utilize are not the same that are used in day-to-day lifting. And so, you know, just doing those CrossFit workouts like I was originally didn't help my neck strength. You know, my neck strength was still weak. And so I'd have a hard time in longer races, keeping my head up. And so when I started going to PitFit, we started introducing neck exercises, as I like to call them, neck exercises. And also doing things like rock climbing, help with grip strength, muscle endurance, things like that. And so there's just different things that we'll work through, different block programs that we'll work through. But I think one of the benefits of that is where they have so many tools to utilize, right? So we'll do a cardio session with, you know, five different machines. And so you're working different muscle groups, but they're all relatively connected. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go hop in the sauna and do some heat training. And then after that, I'll do some reaction training. And mm-hmm. so it's simulating what it's like in the car, because, you know, say it's Nashville and it's 95 degrees out, 90% humidity. You're dying in the car. It's probably 120, 130 degrees in your suit and your helmet and everything, and mm-hmm. you're sweating. And so when you're doing these cardio sessions, they'll have you go sit in the sauna for 20, 30 minutes, and then make sure that your mind is still sharp and active, because it's easy to kind of, what I get, or what I call it, is called brain fade during mm-hmm. a race. And I think that you'll see it sometimes in junior formulas where a driver's leading the race, and then towards the end, they'll just crash for no reason. And it's not like they were pushing a limit. It was just like a mental error. And it's mm-hmm. that brain fade they get from the physical fatigue, where they're not able to stay sharp and focused during that high intensity workout. And so with the heat training, the reaction training, and the cardio, we're, you know, oversaturating our senses to make sure that our brains are still active when we get in the car.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's really why I think a lot of people understand the strength training side of it, right? Just being able to withstand the G-force needed when you're driving the car, right? But I think for some people, it's a little bit more of a question of why do drivers need good cardio? So, but you would frame it more from the aspect then that, you know, having better cardio allows you, even at these moments where you're feeling physically tired, to still be mentally sharp. Is that's kind of how you see it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, physical fatigue is big. Like, obviously, you want to still be able to turn the car at the end of the race and still be able to hold your head up. But I think that if you can get to a fitness level that allows you to be subconscious of the things that you're doing inside the car, meaning you don't have to think about, oh man, I'm struggling to turn the wheel, I'm struggling to hold my head up. It allows your brain capacity to be increased so that you can think about, oh, I can brake 5 feet later, I can carry this 1 mile an hour more. And so your focus shifts to what the things are that can help you go faster rather than how you can survive in the car holding on to the steering wheel.
And so, I mean, I kind of like to joke about this with some people, but how did PitFit pretty much get like a monopoly on training all racing drivers? Because I feel like these days it's like, if I ask somebody, where do you train? They just say PitFit. Even if they don't live in Indianapolis, they're like, oh yeah, I do a PitFit virtual session or something like that. Right. So is it just like, at the moment, there's literally no other facility that caters to you guys in the specific things that you guys need to train for?
Yeah. So there are actually a couple other facilities that drivers will attend. Hunter McElroy was my teammate this last year, and he was a driver that went to a different facility, but Matt Brabham and Christian Rasmussen and I all went to PitFit. And I think it's just because they have a history of being successful with developing drivers to where they need to be fitness wise. And they have also built a program around like specifically drivers. You know, a lot of times I think you'll see like Jim Leo has been around forever with PitFit. I mean, he's the one that started the program. And I think one of his first customers was Scott Dixon. And Scott Dixon is legendary for his fitness. And I think it's because they worked really well together to develop like, oh, okay, my neck feels like a little bit sore, maybe kind of here. And so I think that we need to do this exercise to help that. So I think that Jim did a lot of research in developing a program that allowed them to, you know, really focus on the racing parts of the body. Whereas other gyms might say, hey, these workouts are fairly similar to what you might be doing in the car. Just do that. But it's not as specific and minute as the details that PitFit might have. And I think other gyms are, they can be at that level, but they haven't been around and they don't serve that wide of a range of drivers just because they're a regular gym that may not be known for having that motorsport emphasis.
So in 2021, you made the jump to Indy Lights, still with Juncos, but it was a new car. So how much of an adjustment was that for you? Did you find yourself having to get stronger again, having to change your racecraft skills, qualifying skills, were those all different again, or did you feel like you made a good transition?
Yeah, 2021 was a rough year for me, and I think it was because it was a big jump from Indy Pro into Indy Lights. Not only with the new car, but like even though I was with Juncos, I was working with a different group. I was working with a different engineer, different mechanics, and everyone. The whole culture changed within the team, and so, although Ricardo was still very much involved, I think that his priority was in IndyCar. And so he wasn't as dedicated to sitting in the engineering room with us making those decisions. And so I think just overall, I mean, physically, I felt like I learned a lot in Indy Lights just because the G-forces increased. But the driving style also changed a lot. It's a bigger, heavier, longer wheelbase, more downforce, higher horsepower car. And so you have to drive it a little differently. There's different things that the car likes to go fast. You know, sometimes cars, they'll like more understeer, oversteer. And I think the Indy Pro 2000 car was more of a neutral setup, meaning that it just didn't have like a strong oversteer, understeer. Whereas Indy Lights, if you had any form of understeer, you were going to be slow. And so you had to be on that ragged edge all the time.
Mm-hmm. So then what do you think really changed from 2021 and 2022 then, right? Because, you know, this past season competed with Andretti. So maybe there was just some physical differences in the cars between Juncos and Andretti. But how did you feel you got better as a driver? Because, I mean, you finished second in this year's championship, right? And did incredibly well.
Yeah. So definitely making the transition from Juncos to Andretti was a big deal. During the end of the 21 season, we went to Mid-Ohio for a second weekend. And I actually, in the first practice there, was second on times. And so I think that was kind of like where the light switch flipped for me of like, oh, I can actually do this. I know how to drive the car. I know what it wants. I know what I need to feel in order to go quickly. And then I took that to Andretti. And once I was at Andretti, they have so much resources just from previous drivers, you know, having Pato, Oliver, Colton, Kirkwood, all those guys were previous podium finishers in the championship in Indy Lights. So they had all of that data readily available so that I could comb through and learn as much as I could from those guys. But also working with my engineer, I had the same engineer the whole season in 22 with Andretti. And it was someone that had previous experience in IndyCar. And so he had a lot of knowledge that he could pass down to me. And so I think that's just why we got better and better as the season went on. And I think physically I was more prepared. I started going to PitFit again, like halfway through the season in 2022. And so, I don't know, I think just overall, it was just more of a consistent group of people that I was around, and that I had good teammates that were also challenging me. And then obviously being with Andretti, they're a powerhouse of a team. So they knew what they were doing.
Exactly. So, I mean, again, this could be like a very loaded question. I'm sure there's a lot that goes into this, but like, what does it take to be a successful driver in Indy Lights, in your opinion, then?
You know, I think that one of the big things that allowed me to finish second in the championship was my consistency, because the field was pretty deep. And I think that this next year will be even more so, with, you know, 18, 19 cars in the field. If you have a bad weekend, that can cost you the championship. Whereas if you're finishing fourth, fifth, second, third every weekend, there's something to be said about that, because there's not going to be that big drop in points on that one weekend that you have to make up with a race win or something on later on. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, that was something that I made a decision to do early on in the season, was like, just be close every weekend, like always finish at the front. Maybe sacrifice going for a race win, but if you can finish second and third every single race instead of crashing out, you got to do that. But
you know, also it's really interesting that you have that mindset, because as a competitor, I totally get it. And I feel like there could be some fans that get upset with you for saying that, because I think, where was it? Maybe I think it was mid Ohio. My memory is a bit fuzzy now, but I think Alex Palou was in second, I think, at that race in mid Ohio. And I remember it was like a very similar situation to what you're saying right now, that, I mean, Alex Palou is a very consistent driver, right? Like that's why he won. That's why he won the IndyCar series. Right. And that was, again, the same situation where maybe he was within like distance of getting, I don't even remember who won now, but maybe he was in, I think it was Scott McLaughlin, but he wasn't in shooting distance. And we could all kind of see that slowly he backed off a little bit, became like a little bit more conservative, probably started thinking about bringing home that P2 versus what's the chance of me, you know, like binning the car if I try to go after him. Right. So
yeah,
that's, I mean, I think that's very forthright of you to admit that that's the way you thought this past season.
Yeah. Well, and I think that there is a point during the season where you have to recognize like where the other guys are. And, you know, Linus went out to an early lead in the championship with race wins. And so there was a point where the other drivers and myself, we all said like, okay, now we have to go for race wins. You know, we have to take those chances. We have to be aggressive and risk it, even if it's third, fourth, second, something like that, not for a race win, but you gotta push it, because if Linus has a bad day, you gotta be there to snatch it up, or maybe you just show up and are better than him. And so there were definitely weekends there where it was like, okay, we're throwing caution to the wind and we're going for it. So it's just kind of, you have to read the field, I guess. And you got to understand that based off your experience level, what you're capable of, and know, okay, like I'm pushing 100% right now. And if I push 101%, I might crash. I might cause the weekend to be over. But sometimes you got to jump over that edge and just hope that it works.
Yeah. And I think that's another interesting point, because I think maybe especially if you talk to someone who doesn't maybe understand or know that much about racing, right? They probably think like as a racing driver, you just get behind the wheel and, you know, you just put your right foot down and have a good time, right? And I'm sure there are times where like you probably, I mean, I might imagine that you would probably enjoy just going, you know, balls to the wall the whole time more than having to think about fuel and tires and this and that, right? But I think it is an interesting point to think about. I think good racing drivers are not just necessarily people who are fast, but people who are very controlled and know exactly what lap, how to hold a lap time to preserve this tire, preserve this fuel strategy, things for sure. Like that, right? So, I mean, how much would you say you've learned that in Indy Lights?
I mean, I think that I learned it before that. I mean, in the 2020 season, I saw it a little bit, but I had race wins to go along with that. Mm-hmm. But I think a great example of this is Will Power this previous season, because he even talked to us about it before 22 started. And he said, like, I've worked on my mental game. I'm not going to be this roller coaster of emotions kind of a guy like I've been in the past. I'm going to stay consistent and stay level. And that's why he won the championship, I think, in my personal opinion. Like, he obviously won races, but like, he was the same guy every weekend, and he didn't throw the race away to go for one position. And so I think that he had to recognize that as a driver. You have to be calm and calculated, but also still very aggressive and fast. Like, there's a balance there. And I think that willpower that we've always seen has been this, like you said, balls to the wall, flat out everywhere he goes. And that's why he is such a good qualifier. That's why mm-hmm. he's like the best qualifying driver in history, because that's how he drives. That's who he's been up until this previous season, when he realized, like, okay, my system is quick, but it's not consistent, and consistency wins championships. So I think that different drivers have to focus on different areas of strengths and weaknesses. And I think that to see him make that conscious decision and announce to others was actually a pretty cool thing.
Mm-hmm. How do you think Indy Lights does a good job of preparing drivers for IndyCar? I feel that lately in Europe, we've been seeing more and more people make the argument that recent F2 graduates simply haven't been good enough to make the next step to Formula One, or when they've made that next step, they haven't necessarily impressed, right? But with IndyCar, I kind of feel like it's the reverse, that we've seen people graduate from Indy Lights and do immensely well for themselves, and not just, you know, 1 year, 2 years, like they've made good careers and good names for themselves. So why do you think, I mean, just even in general, the road to Indy has done a really good job of preparing drivers for the final level?
This is going to be maybe a multi-part question here. the thing is with Indy Lights is that it's a different tire compound, a different driving style is required to drive that car. And I actually think the driving style in Indy Lights is more difficult to nail down than it is in IndyCar. Since I just did a test in IndyCar, like I have a little bit of a reference, but I think Indy Lights, like I said, requires a bit more of an oversteery on that ragged edge driving style that some other drivers might not be capable of. And so that when you get into IndyCar, it actually gets easier to draw the time out of the car itself. The time naturally comes to you if you do the things properly. Whereas Indy Lights, it was kind of like a finicky thing where, oh man, that wasn't quite quick enough or quicker because I slid a little bit too much. Like, there's a balance of sliding and sliding too much where it would cause you time loss. And so I think in IndyCar, you're actually going to see a closer window of drivers because the car is a little bit easier to drive than it is in Indy Lights. From the top to the bottom in Indy Lights, I think it's a bigger window because it's more difficult. And so there's going to be a different level of experience or talent or skill or whatever that is that is required to be fast. Mm-hmm. But I also think that the gap from Indy Lights to IndyCar is much closer than it is from F2 to F1. I think F2 to F1 is quite a big jump. And I also think that because of the tire compounds there, that they're not able to prepare the drivers as well for the things that they're going to experience in F1. And I also think that because F1 is an open series and rather than a stock, what is it? The production series, you know, mm-hmm. all the cars are different, that each team requires a different driving style and they have to build the program around each driver. And I think that you can see that with like Red Bull. Red Bull built their car around Max Verstappen, but it made it harder for Sergio Perez to drive. And so mm-hmm. although Sergio Perez is no doubt a very good driver, he looks like a chump next to Max because Max is just, he's in his program. He's in his own designated program. And I think that, like you said, there have been drivers in F2 that have simply just been labeled as not good enough to go to F1. And I think it's because F1, you have to have that adaptability to just step in the car and know how to make it go fast no matter what. Whereas mm-hmm. IndyCar, the reference from Indy Lights is actually fairly similar. The leap is not as much. There's a driving style change, but it's actually a more natural progression than it would be from F2 to F1.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think it's really interesting because you'll see like a few of the open seats this year, right? That, you know, for example, Nick DeVries, yes, he was Formula 2 champion for sure, but also went over to Formula E, drove different cars and did well for himself. You know, same thing, even when the hot seat came up that they opted to sign, you know, Hulkenberg instead of going with another young driver. I think perhaps Logan Sargeant is like the one exception to what we're talking about, right? But in general, like, I feel like there's not a lot of confidence in young drivers over in that side. And there's almost like this reverse where people are more valuing experience now over like youthfulness, right? And IndyCar to me just seems, I mean, IndyCar, like we were talking about before, you have guys like Willpower, Scott Dixon, who are on the older side, right? But you do have a lot of young drivers making it through the ranks and doing quite well for themselves. So maybe the F1 to IndyCar is a bit apples to oranges, but it is interesting since there is a lot of cross-pollination between Europe and the United States in that sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I've also heard as well is that because F1 has gone to the lower profile tire with the bigger wheel, it requires, or not requires, it gives less fuel to the driver. And so they don't feel as much through the sidewall of the tire, whereas IndyCar, because it's still that standard racing sidewall, mm-hmm. it's similar to Indy Lights where you have to lean on it maybe a little bit more, and you can, you know, produce grip in different ways than you can with that lower side profile tire.
Mm-hmm. So speaking a little bit more to like what you're going to be doing this year, what are you going to be doing in 2023? So, I mean, you've already publicly stated that you don't feel like it makes much sense for you to continue in Indy Lights. So you didn't want to continue in that series. So, I mean, you said, you know, two teams that you're talking to right now. How confident do you feel that you're going to get something signed before St. Pete?
Good. I feel very good about it.
And is it going to be like a part-time? Is it going to be a full-time ride? Have you sorted that out yet?
Yeah, so it would be a full-time ride with the deals that we have on the table right now. And we were initially looking at part-time rides. And if I'm honest with you, I didn't know what I was going to be doing before the last season of the year, or last race of the season in Laguna Seca. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have an Indy Lights ride, and I didn't have an Indy car ride. So we just kind of went into the off season, hoping and praying for the best. And so to be in the situation where I am now, where we're negotiating deals for IndyCar, I'm pretty stoked.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel ready? Is there any part of you that's kind of like has some nervous excitement, or, you know, after doing the test, after having a great year in Indy Lights, you just in your head, you're ready and you want to just get going?
I do feel ready. And I think part of that is because of the last test, you know, going 2.5 months without sitting in the car, obviously there's going to be nerves the first time you sit back in one. But even more so when it's like the next category up. And so I was a little bit worried that my transition there might be a little bit rougher than it was, and that I might struggle to like find the speed in the car. But it felt, like I said, very natural to go from, you know, 2.5 months out of the Indy Lights car into the Indy car and be right up to speed. So mm-hmm. I think physically there are a few things that I need to be working on still. Neck strength being one of them. The G-force is in the Indy car a lot more. And so I got to make sure that I'm ready for that. But I mean, in 4 weeks, I'll be ready to go.
You'll be ready to go. So, I mean, okay, assuming that you do get that IndyCar, you know, ride, which I hope it does happen for you, like, what are you most excited about? What do you think you're going to enjoy the most about finally being at that top step?
I mean, this has been the dream from day one, right? Like, to be a professional racing driver. So looking, I mean, even this last year, not knowing what I was going to be doing this next season, thinking back to what my mindset was then, and if I could go back and tell myself, like, don't worry, just know that like this is going to like happen, is so cool. Like, I'm so thankful for all the opportunities that I've gotten to step up to this point. But I mean, I just think back to like the passion that I had as a little kid and like wanting to be a professional racing driver, and like that passion still in me and that little kid still there. So it just feels very rewarding and very fulfilling to be at this point in my stage and mm-hmm. my career.
I mean, and so is that really, at the end of the day, is that still what drives you, just the passion? Because I think, you know, again, for me, I've had like a similar thing that I think from a young age, I've always been interested in cars, interested in racing, right? And then now I'm going to college, and now like this is like the first time, again, for you, probably very similar, like a stage going to Indy Pro, Indy Lights. This is the first time where now you have a chance that you are directly working towards your goal of being in racing, right? So, I mean, mm-hmm. sometimes throughout that, it's like, it's never like a linear process, right? There are a lot of ups and downs. There are probably a lot of doubts that you have for yourself, right? And I don't know, maybe for you, I know for me personally, there's a lot of times where I'll be like, oh, well, like, how do I know that racing is 100% what I want to dedicate my life to, right? Because we've only seen, you know, this much of the world, so little, right? So, yeah. I mean, at the end of it, is it still, you just try to keep it very simple for yourself. You love racing. The passion for it is what drives you every single day.
I think so. And I will be honest, like you said, there are a lot of ups and downs during my career. And there were times where I was like, this is it. Like, I'm done. Like, I can't give anything more. I don't want to give anything more. Like, I'm either not good enough. Things are just not going my way. And it was like at those points in my career and my life that I had to make a choice of like, okay, I have to stay faithful to what God has provided for me and the opportunities that he's provided for me. And so I think that those were the times where I grew the most, because I had to rely on something other than myself. Mm-hmm. And I had to I had to appreciate and be grateful for the things that I was getting. And so I think that that just increased my passion at the end of the day. Even when I didn't want to sit in the car and, you know, lose another race. Like, those were the days that I think really changed who I was as a driver and made me want to work harder now at this stage, because I look back at the person that I was then and I can say, like, I am better for that. I am better for that challenge that I had to go through. And I'm more passionate about what I am doing now because I had to fight for it. You know, yeah. I think that for maybe some drivers and some people in their careers, it's just handed over to them. And they may not feel like that it was that good of a thing for them. They may not feel as grateful for it because they didn't work as hard for it. Mm-hmm. So I think at this point in my career, I'm seeing like the whole picture a little bit of my junior career.
Yeah.
And looking back, I can really say, like, no, I'm grateful for all the things that I went through because it had a purpose in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, it's really funny for you to say that, because I mean, I think on the surface of it, people could argue that we're two probably very different people, in the sense that I want to do engineering side, you're an actual racing driver, right? But some of the things you're saying right now are, you know, very much resonating with me. I mean, it's the same thing for me, that like, I think sometimes it's all about gaining some perspective. And for you, this is a great point in your career to step back and try to take stock of that, right? Because again, like we were talking about, you were no regular 9-year-old in that sense of what you're doing. And it wasn't until you're older that you realize, like, oh wow, like what I'm doing is actually kind of different, you know. And even getting the opportunity to consistently be speaking with guys like you, even sometimes that's something I have to like take a step back and realize, like, hey, wow, like this isn't normal. This is something different. Mm-hmm. Right. And then again, like you gain a lot more appreciation for where you're at in your life when you do take that perspective. So, I mean, okay. For instance, even going forward then, like how do you make sure that you don't become like, what do you say? You know, an IndyCar driver who's full of himself and, you know, people are asking him for signatures and, you know, people are like shouting your name. So how do you make sure you stay humble and allow like that passion to shine through it and not let anything else cloud that?
I think it's a big part of it is being grateful. Like I said, grateful in the little things, grateful for the small details. And I think honestly, like, my faith is a big part of who I am and a big part of where my career has taken me. And so like, I've learned humility from that. Like, there's definitely been days where I'm like pounding my chest, like, oh, I'm good, I'm great. And then the next day I'm like dead last. And for no other reason than I just did terrible. Yeah. And so like, I think those moments, it's like not forgetting of like where you came from and who you are, and whose you are, that really allow you to appreciate where you've been and where you're going to be, and not, like you said, get that arrogance that you may see in other sports or other drivers or whatever else, because at the end of the day, it's not really all about us. I mean, we are the ones that are standing on top of the podium, but if we can point that a different direction and celebrate the other people in our lives, I think that that's really important. And I mean, honestly, I hope that through my career, I can use my platform to make a difference in this world, and that I'm utilizing it to the best of my ability, not just on how to get things for myself. That's not what I mean. I mean, like, actually making a difference in the sense that I want to change people's lives for the better. So
I mean, how do you think a racing driver can do that? Because I think, for example, someone else who has come onto the podcast and who I've gotten to know somewhat well, you might know him, Inam Ahmed. He's racing in Indy Pro. And, you know, he's someone who, you know, he's like of South Asian descent. So for him, very similar, the thing is he wants to race kind of to, he wants to race for diversity. He wants to race to bring attention to, like, you know, he's representing the Pakistan, you know, like, nationality, right? So he uses his racing lot to bring, to bring awareness to some of the problems and stuff that are going on in that nation, try to help like that. So is that something similar? Is that how you see, you know, using your platform to help other people, or is it something slightly different?
No, I think it is similar. There's a book that I read recently, or that I've parked my spot in it. But at the beginning of it, it talks about like how our character is built through experiences, and that sometimes what we are meant to do is what we're called to do. And so I think that each one of us can be called to do different things to make a difference. And so like for me, I look at leaders or people that are making a difference in their world through their careers, such as like Tim Tebow. He's someone that I've always looked up to. And, you know, he's trying to end child trafficking, human trafficking, because that's just something that like he feels called to, in the sense that like he saw that at a very early age on a mission trip. Like, there's people that are being sold by their parents into slavery for things that are not that big of a deal here in America. You know, here in America, we take for granted like water, food, shelter, and like people to survive, they had to sell their kids off in those areas. And so like he's providing clean water, to people in Africa that might not otherwise have that opportunity to live and have those experiences. So I think that like through a platform, you can make a difference in those senses. You can provide opportunity for people that may not get those opportunities to live a life where they can make a choice, you know, right? Like you want people to be free of, you know, just like the overwhelming sin in the world. Like there's so many things in the world that are broken and need restoration. And so I think that because I've been gifted this platform, it gives me opportunity to take care of that. And it's a responsibility that we're all granted when we're at this level.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really interesting to have this conversation with you. I mean, I guess kind of like my next question for you is, and maybe like in some ways through your responses, you've already kind of answered this, but I think a lot of people I meet, again, kind of think of like racing drivers as these stereotypical people that, you know, very like full of themselves, like they just care about being competitive, can be like nasty people sometimes, right? And I think people have like, I think a lot of people look up to racing drivers, not to paint them in a bad picture. But yeah, people have like this one very defined image. And a lot of racing drivers that I've met do have like similar characteristics, similar qualities. But I think one thing for me has just been really interesting. You know, for example, I've not had the conversation we're having right now with a lot of other drivers, right? So like what coming to the IndyCar grid, like why do you think you're going to be interesting for fans? Like what do you think is going to be something very different about your personality that not a lot of other drivers out there are like, you know, like that, like or similar to you in that way?
I hope that the fans will see my humility and that like, it's not always me. You know, one thing that I've tried to cherish as much as possible is the people around me in my life. And so I spend a lot of time with friends and family, whereas other drivers, I think maybe, they're on the road all the time. They might like to party, do all those things where that's not really like my scene. Like I said, I want to make a difference and I want to be the best example I can be to others around me. So I don't know. I think that for the most part, there is that stigma around drivers to be like James Hunt, right? You know,
yeah, sure.
But I don't think that you have to be that way to be a successful driver. I think that there are plenty of other opportunities to be successful, doing the right things. So I hope people see that.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think it's been very interesting to, I think you are kind of a unique personality in that sense. And I definitely get, from our conversation so far today, even seeing that humility and you kind of constantly mentioning the people around you. So no, I do think that would be very interesting. And I mean, for example, you know, like I said, last person that I talked to, you know, in fact, today, even before I met you, you know, I was talking to Devlin, right? And DeFrancesco also races for Andretti. And so it was really interesting to see his personality. And then again, compare it with, you know, a few different other like IndyCar drivers that I know, right? So and that's another thing too. Maybe this goes into like a different topic that a lot of times dealing with, like from an engineering standpoint, if I'm a race engineer, for example, right, dealing with the driver is maybe like a lot of it is human interaction too, right? And so like learning how to deal with your team, things like that. And I think every driver just kind of has something different that works for them, right? And I think that's sure. Also been interesting from my point of view to learn.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that for you as an engineer, it's important to understand that human side, because like for me, I think that part of my success this last season with Andretti was that my communication level was so high with my engineer. He was someone that I was able to feel comfortable and trust, and like there's things, well, I mean, first off, the driver is going to spend the most time with their engineer. Like the relationship between a driver and engineer during a racing season is probably more intensive than maybe some other people's marriages. I mean, to be honest, like we spend a lot of time solving problems together, talking about different things and trying to figure out how to be prepared for the next event or how to learn from the last event, things like that. So there's this constant growth between the communication. So if you understand each other at a higher human level, it allows you to understand how they're going to communicate, how they're going to react, how you guys are going to work through problems together. So yeah, it is interesting to see the different personalities in racing and how they kind of clash or go together in the right direction. And so I think that that's why you see times in motorsports where drivers will have a series of events that lead to several championships in a row, right? Because they had that one guy that spoke into their career and that worked really well with for a short period of time, but then they moved on to something else. Well, then they had to rebuild that. They have to start over. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many variables that go into racing. It's not like golf or basketball or whatever else where it's like, I'm oversimplifying it, but you do a jump shot and then you dunk the ball, you pass the ball, you move around, you play the defense, whatever. Like there's there's communication behind the scenes. There's choices that have to be made for each individual setup. There's a lot of mechanics that are involved. There's also marketing and sponsors that are involved that might allow you to do something that others might not. So there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that you don't always see go into the driver's career, but the results are examples of that. So it's our job as a driver to try and take all that in and control what we can, and then, you know, give the rest away to whatever it may be.
Yeah. I mean, so what's one goal that you have for yourself this season? Like, imagine yourself 1 year's time from now, having been through 2023, what things do you have to do behind the wheel, or perhaps even, you know, off the track, in order for 2023 to be a successful racing year for you?
Well, I think to start, the fitness level has to be where I need it to be competitive, because, you know, mid season, there's weekends that are just back to back to back to back to back. So you don't have time to develop in between that. You already have to be prepared before St. Pete. And so that's my goal first, is just make sure that I'm physically ready and prepared. And then I think the next step is just trying to be consistent. Like I said, make sure that I'm improving every race that I can and finish all the laps. I think that too often rookies in IndyCar, they'll step up in and they will think they need to set the world on fire, and then they'll crash out. They'll make a mistake. They'll do this, that, and another thing, and they'll not complete all the laps. And I think that that's where the experience comes. That's where that learning comes, because you don't just write off the weekend. You can actually look back and say, okay, I made a mistake here, but this thing that we did was actually really good. And so you can actually learn a lot more from a bad weekend where you didn't crash out than you can from a terrible weekend where you crashed out and may have been good had you not made that mistake. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, depending on which team we sign with, there's going to be a lot of opportunity available to me to learn from the other drivers or the previous drivers that have been there. So yeah, I'm excited. I think that it'll be good. And either way, I just hope that I can enjoy it for what it is. I mean, I'm living the dream, so I want to make sure that I'm, you know, taking it all in and being grateful for what I get.
Yeah, of course. Well, my last question for you today, what has been your favorite moment in your racing career thus far?
Oh man. Favorite moment in my racing career so far. 2020 was a pretty cool year to win the championship. That was definitely an emotional season banquet for me, you know, seeing all the people around me that had kind of supported me to that point, and then giving my championship speech. I started bawling. So that was just like one thing I remember, like, I'm not a super emotional person. And so for me to like sit there and not even be able to speak because I was so excited for the opportunity that we had, was pretty cool. But I think more recently, I think the race win at Laguna Seca and Indy Lights was pretty cool as well. That was something that I had been waiting to check off the list, and to do it in the fashion that we did with my engineer, it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. I wish you the best of luck for 2023, whichever, you know, team you do decide to sign on with. You know, I'll be there watching on TV, or hopefully even there at the track to see you. But yeah, wishing you the best of luck for 2023.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of Chasing the Apex. I had a great time speaking with Stingray, and I hope you had just as great of a time giving this podcast a listen. If you'd like to continue to support my work, make sure to give me a follow at ctp.motorsport on Instagram and at SidTalksF1 on TikTok. Thanks again.